Okay, I think we're close enough to 4 o'clock to get started. I'm Ben Davis, and I've always used computers for computing, so I usually look more at numbers than files served or HTTP requests than most of the other people here. And I thought it would be interesting to just talk about some of the problems that you have with numbers that programmers probably know, but users probably don't. And then to fill out things, I just thought it would be nice just to have some fun. Have you ever gotten a wrong answer from a computer? The two areas I'll talk about as far as numbers go is the numbers on a computer don't have infinite precision. They're just finite numbers. And another problem with simulations and other things is chaos, and I'll just touch on that. And the rest of the things I'm not going to cover here, but try to have some fun topics. Software errors, user errors, poor documentation, units. Again, I'm used to using computers for big computations. This one's better read than spoken. It makes more sense. But computers use binary numbers, and they're a fixed length. And the reason for that is it's in the hardware. They can't do it better. And here I have a table with the 3-bit numbers. You can see in 3-bit numbers, there can be two types. They can have a signed number or an unsigned number, whether it can be positive or negative or not. And the interesting thing is the computer only sees the bits. So it only sees the 3 bits when it operates on the numbers. And a consequence of that is some of the things down at the bottom. If you have a signed number, 3 plus 1 is -4. And that's what the computer gives you, and that's typically not what you think of as a right answer. Likewise, if the number's unsigned, you get 7 plus 1 is 0. And another thing, usually you get a compiler warning for this that always says, you know, comparing signed and unsigned, but 5 equals -3. As you can see, they're the same number to the computer. And another one people get confused on is 2 divided by 3 is 0. Python 3 is trying to change that, but. And you say 3 bits isn't a very big number, but what about looking at factorial? Factorial is a nice function. It's a number, and what it is a product of all the numbers less than that number. So 4 factorial is 1 times 2 times 3 times 4. And the thing about factorial is it grows pretty quickly. And another thing you want to know is that the factorial of a number is equal to that number times the factorial of 1 minus that number, which works out good for spreadsheets and stuff. But again, you think 3 bits isn't very big. Computers got 8 bytes usually for a long integer. So I got a few answers from 8-byte numbers here. You can see 20 factorial, 20 is not real big, but 20 factorial is. You take that and multiply it by 21, well, you get a negative number. That's because it's overflowed the number. Now that's interesting, if you keep going, you got 64 factorial, multiply that by 65 and you get the same number. If you multiply by 66, it goes to 0. So you can see where computers get wrong answers working with integers, and you think these are just integer calculations, but to the computer also an address is an integer. And a lot of times you'll run into these problems with computer addresses, especially a lot of times trying to put -1 in for an address and it'll give you some great big number. (laughs) 70 factorial. I like that. I call it a Google plus. A Google is 10 to the 100th power, and 70 factorial is just a little bit bigger than that. I was going to say right here, this year I've heard that Google, the company, actually has surpassed a Google of data. that they store, which is a lot of data. And in most programming languages, I've done all those, it ends up with zero. Because once you got to 66, it stays at zero. The old hand calculator usually only has 99 for the exponent, so it just gives you an error. Spreadsheets that I tried, LibreOffice, Calligra Sheets, and Numeric, convert the number to a floating point number so it can hold the big number, but it's not as accurate. It's interesting, Python and Lisp gave the right answer. And some of the things I was going to talk about is DC and BC, which are old Unix programs, and some libraries that can work with big numbers. We heard GMP in an earlier talk today, and Big Integer is a Java package. But if you take a spreadsheet and you make the cell larger, you can see the whole number. It's kind of interesting. There's a difference here. LibreOffice fills it with zeros, which sort of tells you how accurate the number is. Except, if you look at the right answer, it's got a lot of zeros on the end anyway, too. Because every time you multiply by 10, you add a zero. Calligra Sheets and Numeric fill out random numbers. If you care, Calligra Sheets is, for this number, just slightly more accurate. Another thing spreadsheets have is they have a function, a factorial function. So you can do it with an equation or a function. And this one compares with the equation on the left and the function on the right. Just formatted to be a little bit of fun. They do get the same answer. What I like is DC and BC. DC is a very old program. It actually predates C. It's one of the first Unix programs. It's a stack-based calculator. As old folks might know, RPN or reverse Polish notation. It is, I'd say, arbitrary, but as much as the computer can hold. And it basically does integer arithmetic, but you can allow the decimal point to shift. BC, or basic calculator, bench calculator, or some people called it better calculator, is more C-like, and originally it was just a shell that piped through DC. But what I say, when you're going to use BC, use BC-L, which adds a math library. So now you've got sine, cosine, arctangent, log, exponent, and Bessel functions. And it also sets the precision to 20 digits, which is good. Some libraries I already mentioned. It's interesting, we've got two GNU multiple precision libraries. One's GMP and one's MPFR. The MPFR has more functions. And they also have a complex numbers versions for those going into complex numbers and math. Two other libraries I have no experience with myself are DD and QD, have a fixed precision, but it's high precision. There's 32 digits and 64 digits, whereas typical numbers are like 15 digits. And PerryGP is another program that does computer algebra as well as arbitrary precision. And it's a library or a shell. But we saw that integers aren't accurate. And for floating point numbers, they have a number called epsilon, which really tells the accuracy of the numbers. It's defined as the smallest number such that 1 plus epsilon is not equal to 1. Or the better way to look at it is 1 plus delta, if delta is a little bit smaller than epsilon, is equal to 1. And that's not a typically not a correct statement unless delta is zero. And for the IEEE standards, those are fairly small numbers. Single precision is something 10 to the minus 7, and double precision is minus 16. The one thing a lot of people don't consider is that CPU registers typically have a little bit more precision. And what happens there is if you're working with numbers that need high precision, is if you change your optimization as you compile, you can get different answers because the numbers will stay in the registers longer. There's some other reasons that precision is important. The function you're using just may be very sensitive. Here you can see if you're using arc cosine very near one, a change in the tenth decimal place doubled the result. This could be important for astronomers trying to measure distances to galaxies and stuff like that. They use these numbers. Another place you lose precision is subtraction of nearly equal numbers. Here's two numbers I've subtracted. The X's are just garbage digits. And you can see we went from 12 places to 5 places. This comes into play a little bit like you're just solving a regular quadratic equation. Everybody with some high school algebra usually does this. But what if the b squared is about equal to 4ac, so you're subtracting two nearly equal numbers, or it's much greater than there, or much less than the 4ac? Typically, because you've got an x squared, you're losing about half the digits anyway. I did some programming on that, and the only one that made any difference was the middle one, where b squared is much, much greater than 4ac, so you have a big answer and a very little answer. And there's a different way of solving it that makes it much better. With the typical straightforward way, the error is actually bigger than the answer by plugging it back in. But just changing the way that you solve it can make your answer more accurate. But ultimately, if you want to use more precision, it's about time. A couple of quotes, or one quote is, the value of time is inversely proportional to how much of it you have left. I was doing homework assignments, know that one. But what if you're using a high precision library or something and it makes your code or the computation 50 times longer? If the computation took 1 millisecond, okay, you hit it and you see the response. Okay, 50 times slower, you hit it, and a 20th of a second, you see the response. Most people aren't going to know the difference. Unfortunately, that's what happens a lot of times. Where I've worked, a 4-day computation is more common. And 50 times slower, now you're talking 6 months. So you can't just rack up the precision with some of these libraries. And I found this example. A package I like is Sage, sagemath.org. It's Python, but it has a lot of math libraries built into it. And he was just compared it to a typical engineering type problem on a 500 by 500 grid. And if you just use pure Python, it would take about 30 minutes to solve the problem. Python has something they call NumPy, which is essentially allows Python to use C arrays for matrix operations and math operations and stuff. And that cuts it down to 30 seconds. That's about 60. But you can also call a Fortran subroutine to do it. And the Fortran subroutine is about 2 seconds. And those times are pretty much what I've seen across the board. Fortran will be much, or C would be much faster than the newer languages, the scripting languages, Python or Java or anything like that. But how much does this extra precision cost? I did find some data. Somebody is translating matrix packages to use these higher precision math libraries. And you can see the DD, which is the number in parentheses, is the number of digits of accuracy. So a double is about 15 digits, or 15 decimal places, and DD32, it's 10 times, at least 10 times, 10 to 300 times the time to compute. GMP is pretty fast, at 77 digits, 132 times. And the MPFR, interestingly enough, which uses GMP, is about half as fast as GMP for the same 154 digit precision. Okay, it's your turn. Anybody with a computing device, a calculator or something else? I've got a little problem here. Is somebody got something to do something? Even if you have a phone with a busy box on it, the DC will work on that. But you pick three digits, any three except zeros, and enter them twice as one number. And that number is divisible by 11. And you can take that number and divide it by 7. And then divide by, again, the original three-digit number. Anybody want to say what you get? Must not.
33.9268. I got
13. Okay, there's a right answer. Your lucky day. Does anybody have this? Periscivitica-triaphobia?
I did it with BC minus L.
Yeah. Did you use?
33.9.
It should be 13. I've got it down.
Just type in the way you did. Oh, I used a different number.
It should work with any number, because when you type the digits together, it's just 1,001 times the three-digit number, and then you divide it back out. So it should always give you 13. Okay, that's for Friday the 13th. They say if you can pronounce it, it'll cure your fear. But anyway, today, of course, is Friday the 13th, but it's the first Friday the 13th of 2013, which is kind of interesting. And in 13 weeks, we get another Friday the 13th. But it's really, we're talking about numbers, so we're really interested in triskaidekaphobia, or the fear of the number 13. Let's look at the number 13, see if we can have some fun things about 13. 13's a prime number. That's a good number. It's also an emirp. That is, of course, prime spelled backwards, so 13 and 31 are both primes. It's a happy number. How can it be unlucky if it's a happy number? It's also a Wilson prime, and there's only three known Wilson primes. And in the definition of Wilson prime, we see our friend the factorial. Just a note, to prove this, you'd have to do 563 factorial, which is a pretty big number. It's also a Fibonacci number. And that brings up another question. What's the smartest mammal? Rabbits. They can multiply very fast. But really, here's where Fibonacci came in. He actually studied rabbit multiplication. And actually, his real name is Leonardo Pisani Bigelow, and he's of Pisa. And I don't know where they got Fibonacci out of that, but it was really a landmark book, a publication. It's actually what brought Arabic numbers to Europe. Because prior to that time in Europe, they all used Roman numerals. And one of his examples was this rabbit breeding example where he defined the Fibonacci numbers. The Fibonacci numbers themselves were actually known probably 600 years before that as possibilities of arranging, in this case, in the image, bricks. Where you can have a brick that's twice as long as it is high, and you stack them too high, and the Fibonacci number actually tells you how many different ways that you can stack those bricks. Fibonacci also has a spiral. If you draw squares at each side, you see Fibonacci numbers for the size of the square, size of the sides of the square, and you can draw an arc, and you end up with a spiral. And this spiral happens to appear in nature quite a bit. Sunflowers and pine cones, if you look at them, have this spiral in them. And the reason it's that spiral is because objects of the same size can pack in a radial shape very compactly, and they'll have that spiral. You also see it in seashells, but not seashells. And there's a picture of a Nautilus shell cut in half that shows you that spiral appears in nature. But what I think is neat is when I was younger, my kids would always ask me, what's your favorite number? And I'd say the golden ratio. They say Fibonacci numbers, the ratio of Fibonacci numbers approaches the golden ratio. And what is the golden ratio? Well, if you have a line segment, you can divide it. And you divide it in a place where the ratio of the longer segment to the shorter one is the same as the ratio of the total length to the longer one. That's Euclid's definition. And it's given the symbol phi, which is named after a Greek, Phidias, who's a Greek sculptor, and he studied the golden ratio. And he said it was the most beautiful rectangle. So my kids would ask me, what's a golden ratio used for? Well, it's aesthetically pleasing. And another interesting thing about the rectangle, though, is if you take a square out of it, you end up with a smaller rectangle that also is the golden ratio. But more recently, there's actually been some other findings and uses for the golden ratios. There's Penrose tiles, studied about 1970 by Sir Roger Penrose. And basically, they have either pair on the left or pair on the right shape, but the edges have a proportion of the golden ratio, or the capital phi, which is 1/1 the golden ratio. And an interesting thing about this is you can't really buy those. Roger Penrose is very protective of his discovery of the shape. He patented it and everything else, so you can't go out and buy them. Also, in 2011, the Nobel Prize in chemistry was for quasicrystals. And quasicrystals have this similar structure. They're 3D. And it's a non-repeating crystal. So that it adds very unique properties to those. And phi is related to 1/5 of the circle down at the bottom, or a pentagram, as it turns out. There's different ways of calculating the golden ratio. It's a continued fraction with ones all the way. Or you can do it as a continued square root, or there's a straightforward quadratic equation. And I asked, do you like stand-up comedians? Well, here's a bunch of one-liners in DC to calculate the golden ratio. It turns out DC is very compact. DC only has a grand total of 40 commands. And you can do a lot in a single line. Most commands are like one character long or numbers. DC was actually used for an encryption and the famous two-line DCSS thing uses whatever. Disk encryption, DVD encryption, decoding used DC. I can walk through DC here. Here's the equation form of it, which is the shorter form. You can see the stack is on the right, and the command is on the left, and what it does in the middle. So this first can 67 is a number, so that just goes onto the stack. K takes the top number off the stack and sets the precision. So now our stack's empty. Put a 5. 5 goes onto the stack. V kind of looks like a square root, and that's what it does. It pops a number, takes a square root, pushes it back on the stack. A stack, you can only access the top element. So 1 pushes a number, so now you have 2 numbers on the stack. But then the plus pops both those numbers, adds them, puts it back. 2, we put another element on, divide, we divide them. And then finally, the P actually prints the result so that we can see it. 1.618. What I like to do at DC is set the precision up and have it print these 3 numbers. I've skipped a middle in the bigger numbers, but you can tell these 3 numbers are different only in the left-hand digit and the right-hand digit. One of the interesting things about the golden ratio is that 1 over the golden ratio, which is the capital phi, is equal to phi minus 1. And phi squared is equal to phi plus 1. So the top number is 1 over phi, the middle number is phi, and the bottom number is phi squared. So that's just something I consider fun. You can also do this with Python. Python in the manual has this problem, 1.1 plus 2.2, and you get 3.3 plus a little bit, because decimals in normal Python can't be represented exactly. But Python has a decimal module, which you can see calculates the same phis, except it's a little bit different on the right side. Another math problem for those into math is, can an irrational number to an irrational power give you a rational number? And they show this is a common example where yes, it can. And you can use Python and set the digits up and again find out that almost no matter how many digits you put, it comes out just quite not equal. Again, a computer is finite precision. It can't do irrational numbers. Every number on a computer is a rational number. So it only approximates it. Now let's talk about chaos. I'm talking about chaos in the mathematical sense. It's a problem with simulations in that two main characteristics, one they call the butterfly effect, which means that just a small difference in the initial condition can change the results later on. It's typically called that. The description was the flap of a butterfly's wing in Brazil can eventually result in a hurricane in Mexico. And it has to do with math, and chaotic functions are like weather simulations are chaotic. And that's why you can only get 7 days, roughly, of weather prediction. See, what do we? Okay. There's two recurrence relations that are often used to study chaos. One's a logistics equation, or the one I'm going to use is down at the bottom, where the next number in the sequence is equal to the prior number squared minus 2. The number's between minus 2 and 2. And if you plot this up, where I started two simulations, one with 0.5 and one with 0.4 and 12 nines. And for the first 20 iterations, they're pretty close. But if you run a little bit further and you get to 80 to 100, they don't resemble each other at all. Again, this is what happens with weather where, say, above the line is rain, and you can see the blue line where you started at 0.5, it's going to rain a lot more than the red line. But I looked at this relationship a little bit more, and a couple of other things pop out at you is there's an infinite number of initial conditions that all go to x equals 2. Here, if you start out with the square root of 2, you see the next number is 0, square root of 2 squared minus 2. And you have 0, and you go to minus 2, and then you get 2, and 2 squared minus 2 is 2, so it just stays at 2. So that was interesting, and what I did here was just started at a number and compute backwards. Go to earlier in the sequence, and the thing is, you get a plus or minus. So I figured, okay, I'll just do a plus and then a minus and see what I end up with. And I went down there and I said, hey, those numbers look familiar. That's almost my favorite number. And you see that they're converging to the golden ratio, and sure enough, if you put the golden ratio into the relation, you just get a flip. You get inverse golden ratio and negative golden ratio, just back and forth. So golden ratio popped up again. Finally, I know I'm not good at math, but if I can get 95% of the problems right, who cares about the other 10%? I've heard that before, and it actually makes a point that you're wrong more than you think. Now we'll switch gears completely, and one of the things that's fun is to look at history, and I found two of the founding fathers were pretty good at math and liked math. You've got Thomas Jefferson. Actually was responsible for bringing mathematics to universities in the United States as a true subject, a true department. He did it at University of Virginia and West Point. He also went in and argued Congress passed a law on distributing representatives, because the Constitution says we're going to distribute representatives a certain way. Well, it turns out you have fractions of representatives left over that have to go to states. And so they wrote a law, and Thomas Jefferson went into his good friend George Washington and said, this isn't right. They didn't say how they got the numbers. He says, you gotta have the math that was done and how it was done so that the next time they have to do the apportionment, they can do it the same way. So that's actually one of only two vetoes that George Washington did. Remembers that term or what. He's also a very big fan of statistics. I like that he promoted that laws should only last for 20 years and then they should be verified that they did what they were supposed to do. By statistics or numbers. But you can run into a problem. Statistics can be political. Let's say Britain, during World War I, supposedly almost stopped issuing helmets. Why would they stop issuing helmets? Well, the generals were complaining because they said that helmets increased incidence of head wounds 12-fold, and doubled total casualties. And a logical person said, helmet shouldn't do that. Well, something hidden in their numbers is that a fatality was not a casualty. So much less people were dying, but they were getting hurt. So you've got to watch statistics that way. There's another one. It's almost flu shot season. And I looked up some information on how effective flu shots are. And there was really only, in this report, they accepted three studies, double-blind, you know, CDC-approved studies on the effectiveness of flu shots. And I'm going to tell you now, getting the flu shot reduces your chance of getting the flu by 5%. Most people say, I don't want to get a flu shot. But it's also 73% effective at preventing the flu. How can both numbers be right? Well, your chances of getting the flu without the flu shot were only 7%. So going from 7 to 2% is a big improvement. Another thing with these studies is usually a bug is most likely food poisoning and not the flu. In these studies, they only verified it was the flu. Another founding father is Benjamin Franklin. We all know he was pretty good. He was an inventor. He invented the lightning rod, the Franklin stove, and bifocals. Most people know that. But he would fit well in our community. He did not patent any of them. He thought inventions were for the people. He founded the first public library, first fire company, and first police service. He worked in the post office and really set them up to be very efficient. He's most noted for, at least in Europe and outside the US, for his work with electricity. The lightning kite experiments and flow of electricity, and he did actually a lot there. But another fun thing he did was work with magic squares. Here's a magic square, if you haven't seen them before. This is the typical 3x3 square shown here. And you can look at it and see that each row adds up to 15, each column adds up to 15, and the diagonals add up to 15. So it's a fun thing to do. And today with spreadsheets, there's a sequence, and you can make any sized magic square through a set of equations in a spreadsheet. Basically, there's four different equations. You go up at the diagonal, start with 1 at the top, and then add 1 to the moving up and to the right. So, and if you hit a boundary, you go back down to the bottom. So there's four equations in a spreadsheet. You can do any size you want. Here's an 11 by 11 where I've color-coded the equations. So it's pretty straightforward to do these in a spreadsheet, and you can make them as big as you want that'll fit in the spreadsheet. Okay, but Benjamin Franklin's square was a little bit different because the diagonals did not add up to the total, but what he called a bent diagonal. That's 16 by 16, and every bent diagonal, which goes down to the middle and then goes back the other way in all four directions, and it can cross the boundary, so it goes from the right side to the left side. So all of those lines add up to the same total as the rows or the columns. Also, each 4x4 square in here, 4x4 square, adds up to the same total. That makes, there's 352 ways that you can get the same total. And there's only 256 squares. So that's pretty impressive. And to make it a little bit more impressive, each half row and half column, that is the top half and the bottom half, also adds up to half of the number. So this was an interesting magic square by Ben Franklin. The next thing, my family's a little bit musical, and one of my favorite things to say about music is the 12th root of 2. And the reason the 12th root of 2 is so important in music is that that is a half step on the scale, if you're using the right tuning. But music is a lot about fractions, yeah. That's quarter notes, eighth notes, those are fractions. But with this half step being the 12th root of 2, so to go up a half step, you multiply the frequency by the 12th root of 2. And the interesting thing that happens is the numbers in the column, you see that they're very close to simple fractions. And all the thirds, fourths, and fifths fractions between 1 and 2 are very close to some of these numbers. The ones in red, two of them in red, are the only ones that are further than 1% different than the frequency. So you get a lot of fractions building up, and that's what really allows your music to have so much variety. Since it's a multiplication, it also doesn't matter what note is the bass note, you still get the same fractions in the scale. This just shows that a C and an A scale have the same fractions. But I thought I liked the golden ratio. What if I come up with a music scale using the golden ratio? So I looked at some of the powers of golden ratio and put them into a scale. And it was interesting that there were only two step sizes in this scale, a 1.16 and a 1.06. And another thing was that the only fractions within a percent were really strange fractions, 7/6 and 13/8. So I lost all the fractions that we had before. But I'm not really, take another look at this one closer. I saw that the one step size was almost identically equal to the 12th root of 2. It's only 0.04% different. So that was a coincidence, and there's four of those in each octave. Then this bigger step was too big for me, so I tried to figure out if I could divide that into the same step size as the smaller step. And I could get two of those in with a little bit left over. So I said, okay, we'll divide this one into three steps. So now I had three of those before, and I divided them into three steps. So that makes nine steps. And then I had four above there. So would anybody want to use this scale now? You add up the total intervals, and there's 13. Unlucky number. I can say I hope you had fun with this presentation. Are there any questions?
So how's the scale sound? How does the scale sound?
Well, I didn't want to try to do the sound. I have it on the other longer presentation. I was getting short on time, so I cut them off. But to me, it sounds okay, but I'm kind of, I even did chords and they sounded good. But I'm not good at that. Are there any other questions?
What sort of computations do you do? What sort of computations do you do? You mentioned, you know, you may do a
Yeah, I actually retired now, but I used to do CFD on scramjets. So we were doing, you know, gigabyte files of data, the processing and stuff like that. So that's one thing I'm a bit disappointed in with Linux is that is really a market that I think Linux still could be good at is the engineering market and computational market. We have a problem with CAD packages right now as a big weakness. Let's see, I sent them in. I can get them online. If you want, I've got a card here and I got a blog and I'll put a post in. A happy number for 13, you take each digit and square it and add it together, and then you get another number. And you keep doing that until you get a repeating number or sequence of numbers or one. If you get one, it's a happy number. The first time you get 10, but then you get 1 squared plus 0 squared, and that's 1.
Oh.
You keep doing it until you get either a cycle or 1. If you get a 1, it's resolved, it stays there, it's happy. Otherwise, it just keeps spinning around and around. Okay.